I still like my idea.
Do you want to host? Go ahead,
yeah,
host.
Yeah, for me and James are like the younger rebooted versions of you.
Yes,
and Chris.
Yes, go for it. I don't.
I'm like the rebooted Uncle Ben, so I'm the Martin Sheen in this, right?
No, you're the reboot of you're Chris. You're like reboot Chris, and I'm reboot Earl. That's how this works.
Okay, so since Chris is the, if not older, more responsible one, that makes me Martin Sheen and you,
Sally
that
Field.
Young kid, yes.
I'm not, I don't want to be Sally Field.
Sorry.
No.
Wait, fuck, I have to raise Andrew Garfield?
I'll be Andrew Garfield. You can still be Uncle Ben.
Okay.
Wait, aren't you... older than him?
No, he's older than. Isn't James older than me?
I think
whatever,
so.
Whatever. If you're gonna start.
Wait, hold on. What year were you born?
93.
What month?
March.
Damn it. Okay, yeah, he's older.
What, like July or something?
October.
Okay, so you're saying you're gonna come down to Mississippi in October and we'll buy drinks.
Good evening, one and all, and welcome to the Nerds on the welcome to the Nerds on the Rocks podcast. I am the reboot version of Earl, who some people call Justin, and with me I have the rebooted version of Chris, who is known as James.
Wait, I thought I was Martin Sheen.
Shut up. And we have the 2003 version of Earl, who still goes by Earl.
This is such a confusing intro.
Makes no sense.
And we have Chris.
Yeah. Great. I'm like the 1978 version of me, though.
No. That's too mean. You're like 1988 at best.
So I'm like the original Batman.
Yes, you're like the original Batman.
Yeah. The only problem is, reboots never do as well as the original, so let's hope you can do better.
It's true.
Yeah. This week on the Amazing Spider-Cast, we're doing The Amazing Spider-Man 1, the 2012 reboot of the of Sam Raimi's series, which began in 2002. I can't do this. You need to do it.
Spider-Man does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size. Catches
thieves,
just like flies. Look out! Here comes the Spider-Man.
That was very shocking.
Justin is not ready to drive this man.
I know. I thought I could do it, but I
screwed up.
Okay. After the median success of Spider-Man 3 in 2007, Sony, after kind of forcing Sam Raimi out of the director's chair, decided to reboot the franchise in one of the shortest reboots in history. I think Hulk's up there as well.
Is it really that short? Oh, being only 10
it's
years?
It's like 5 years. Well, I mean,
yeah,
between the last version of the new
between movies, if you just count with the last Raimi one in 2007 and this one in 2012, I think Hulk had the same gap year-wise.
Yeah, Hulk was 5 years,
was
2003
yeah,
to 2008.
2008.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that's the fastest. I would not be surprised if, because I know there were a bunch of remakes back like the 20s and 30s, there might have been one that happened with a smaller gap between them, but I'm not sure. But then again, back then, copyright was a little bit more lax, so you'd be like, another Ben-Hur coming out.
Yeah, and I guess this is cheating. I would feel like those are just different interpretations. Like, when they had, like, the different monster movies and stuff, it was just, like, using the source material. Like, this is basically, it's a reboot. It's like, we have this trilogy, we're going to take this character, and we're going to put our own spin on it. And that's what they did. So, in place of Tobey Maguire and Kristen Dunst and J.K. Simmons and James Franco, we got Andrew Garfield as Peter Parker, Spider-Man, Emma Stone as Gwen Stacy, Bryce Ivan as Dr. Kurt Connors, the Lizard, Dennis Sherry as Captain George Stacy, Martin Sheen as Ben Parker, Sally Field as May Parker, and a bunch of other people who aren't that important to this film. I mean, really,
I mean, you're right.
And I think that's something we'll get to in the sequel as well, is that this franchise does tend to have an excess of characters who don't really add a ton to this film, or this franchise. But, yeah. The problem with rebooting Spider-Man was, especially with the Raimi films, which actually did his origins really well, is there isn't a ton of new things to tell in his origin story. So we kind of got the addition of the subplot with his parents being the backbone of this franchise.
Well, to be fair, from what I can tell, the Amazing franchise seems to be taking a lot of influence from the Ultimate Marvel lineup, which actually does focus on Peter's parents quite a bit.
Well,
and their connection to Oscorp.
Well, we'll get to that in a bit, but yeah, it's still iffy. I guess more on the execution than the actual concept. Like, the idea of it's fine, the execution needs a lot to be desired. But what doesn't leave a lot to be desired, at least for me, is I think the casting in this film is much better than the Raimi films.
Really?
Oh, for sure.
I mean, I agree
there
with you.
There are some casting choices in this movie that are absolutely brilliant and head and shoulders above the Raimi ones. I think there is one in particular that is half perfect and half awful. And unfortunately, it's our lead, Andrew Garfield.
Wow.
Though I'm actually not sure how much of this is due to his performance and how much of this is the script, but I think he does make a very good Spider-Man. Like, I think he has a really good wit. I think he's able to, you know, keep it under control, much like how Maguire was able to have that wit.
Maguire had no wit. There was no wit.
Maguire
was dry.
To deal with the danger. Like, it was sort of the difference between the way Sean Connery Bond would make sarcastic quips and, say,
Roger Moore
or Daniel Craig would. It was less them being flippant at danger and more of them trying to find a way to deal with the situation. Like, Garfield's sarcastic remarks are very much more in line with a lot of the earlier comics, where they're very much his flippant way of admitting he's not really worried by the danger or not. His Peter Parker, again, I'm not sure how much of this is him as the actor and how much of this is him as the script, but it's kind of all over the map and generally lines up pretty poorly as a character. Like, there was very little time where I actually had any idea what kind of person he was supposed to be.
Like, what exactly?
Well, I suppose the best way to put it is that the way he acts very rarely is, like, lines up with the way the rest of the characters around him are acting. Like, most of the time, he's doing this really awkward, sort of disaffected young teenager mumbling James Dean type shtick. Yet everyone around him is still acting like he's the same kind of awkward nerd that Tobey Maguire did in his earlier Spider-Man movies. Like, it's this bizarre disconnect that never really clicks. Like, I suppose the best way to put it is that I honestly think this Peter Parker is kind of a self-centered jerk.
And I actually think that's true, but I actually think that works.
Yeah.
Again, we kind of mentioned this with the original trilogy, in that he's in high school. And he's kind of a loner because he doesn't have any friends, and we'll get to that more with the sequel. But it works for his performance because he basically has on this tough interior because he doesn't make friends easily. So he's trying to be cool when it's like, you know, we mentioned with the Venom thing where he's pretending to be that's his version of cool. This is his version of cool. He's aloof because he doesn't want anybody to hurt him because the people closest to him were his parents who left him at the doorstep and never came back. So he doesn't want to get hurt by making anybody get close to him.
And, well, like, just speaking for myself, teenagers are kind of dicks. Like, they're disrespectful, they're rude, they're flippant, they act nonchalant when they really, like, actually do care about something.
So it felt
pretty realistic. And the way that Peter acts in this, like Chris said, like, they don't always think with their head, like, 90% of the time.
Yeah, I think the part of the problem with me with that is that it doesn't really line up with the way he acts a lot of the time. Like, I think a good example of that is sort of with the Flash, with him, like, stopping Flash Thompson from bullying that kid. Like, he does that before he becomes Spider-Man, so as a result, there's really no change in him between when he, like, there's really very little difference between his Peter Parker and his Spider-Man in that regard. Like, I don't really feel like there's any, like, at, like both in terms of that part and through the rest of the movie, that he ever really goes through any kind of arc. Like, he begins the movie in sort of the same way that he comes out of it.
And I can actually agree with that. You're right. He doesn't, like, you know, with Tobey Maguire, he went from the kind of shy, geeky kid to kind of having a backbone and sticking up for himself. But here, even though he does get picked on, the only difference that changes is he now has powers to fight back. It doesn't necessarily give him more confidence.
You know, I think a lot of that has to do with, like, I don't think every adaptation has to check off a bunch of things, which sort of surprised me, some of the changes they made, considering how often this movie very much does retread the same ground as the original Spider-Man. But I feel like a lot of that comes with their, I'm going to say it, they screwed up the Uncle Ben's death completely in this movie. Like, I know I know a lot of people are tired of hearing the "with great power comes great responsibility" line, but I think the reason that worked is that is effectively the lesson of the first Spider-Man movie. And, you know, they stated that, they both state it outright within the direct text, and then on top of that, it becomes effectively the driving thrust of Peter's arc. Like, that is the lesson he learns in the original movie, is that, yes, I have been granted these powers, and as a result, I have a responsibility to help everyone that I am capable of with these powers. Maguire's Peter does not learn that. Like, if you look at your...
You mean Garfield.
Right, Garfield. Maguire's Parker absolutely learns that. Garfield does not learn anything. Like, if you compare, like, this Uncle Ben death to every other one, like, the essential element that drives 99% of the depictions of Uncle Ben's death is Uncle Ben dies because in some way or another, Peter refused to use his powers for the benefit of others, and as a result, he discovers that his failure to act has consequences, and then as a result, he learns that he has a responsibility to use his abilities for the benefit of everyone else, not just for his own selfish gains. And well, he doesn't really learn that.
I think you're missing, like, that, yeah, that happens in this movie.
That does happen in this movie, especially, like, after Spider-Man 3. I would totally disagree with your assessment of that. Because Spider-Man 3 just basically takes Peter's guilt and just sweeps it under the rug in favor of someone who didn't need it at all. And this is directly Peter's fault. This is something that he could have stopped, powers or no powers. And he learns that lesson the hard way. And well, the fact that he continues to go after the thief and, like, chase down leads and anyone who looks like him shows that he really did, like, sort of learn from what Ben was trying to tell him.
I was actually going to say that's the opposite essence, and I think it's a novel one. And that he continues to use the power selfishly once Uncle Ben dies. It's once he meets Captain Stacy and he realizes that he's using the power for selfish means and not necessarily understanding the system, that he begins to use...
I get what you're saying, and I think that could have been the direction they did, but I think the problem is that it feels less like that was the point, was that he needed to learn that the selfish desire of revenge for it was bad, and more that they forgot about it. Because, I mean, think of what happens after he has that conversation with Captain Stacy. He doesn't really change like the way he's... Like he basically just forgets about the revenge plot, and then less like he gives it up, and more that the movie just sort of forgot about it. I mean, think about what he goes to after that. It's not like he goes off stopping criminals and doing... and general do-gooding. He just... Like, the main arc that he has, like, the stuff he does with his powers after that is stopping the Lizard. Why? Because he created him. The only responsibilities he's taking are for the things he directly caused. Whereas the point of Spider-Man is that is that with his great power comes the responsibility to do everything he can for everyone, not just cleaning up his own messes.
Well, I mean, technically, it wasn't his own mess. I know he feels responsible for it, but it's not like he was the one who injected him or anything like that. And he does fight the Lizard without knowing as Kurt Connors the first time, and that's a very unselfish act. And I think a lot of it is unselfish. I think the problem with that is he kind of gets muddied with a lot of different characters and ambitions at the same time, especially being that I think Gwen Stacy has a much bigger role in this film than Mary Jane had in, like, the first two Spider-Man films, where she doesn't just get to be the damsel in distress.
I think Gwen Stacy's role compared to Mary Jane's role is somewhat less in this compared to the first Spider-Man, absolutely diminished compared to something like Spider-Man 2. And, like, I know a lot of people praise this movie heavily for the romance element. I think this is one of the most embarrassingly executed love stories in a mainstream Hollywood film. Like, there's no arc to their romance. Like, they meet each other and basically like each other immediately. And I know I hate to bring the Twilight comparison up, because Twilight is often hated for rightful reasons. They're awful written books with awful sexist backwards messages. But the romance, very much like Edward and Bella's, doesn't really have an arc to it. It's all very wishy-washy and, like, juvenile, and has nothing really to it beyond...
And it should be juvenile.
They're teenagers.
Like, it makes perfect sense that their relationship would be juvenile.
Right.
They're not 25-year-olds. They're, you know, juniors in high school.
Like, well, the way that they act, like, during that scene in the hallway, that's kind of... That's how I acted as a teenager. That's how a lot of kids acted.
Right,
like,
great. Like, they're both awkward. They both don't know what's going on. Like,
right.
He doesn't know how to approach it, how to approach asking her out. Like, it's perfectly reminiscent of every interaction that somebody goes through in high school with a girl
for the first time.
Right.
I suppose the two problems that with is sort of like I said, A, there's no conflict to the romance. Like, they like each other immediately, and it basically just becomes navel shoegazing of flirting. And B, just because teenagers act like that doesn't mean just depicting it straight and saying, yeah, that's cool, is a good way to do it. Like, take a look at something like The Spectacular Now, for example, starring Shailene Woodley, who is going to appear as Mary Jane in the sequel. In that one, they basically do acknowledge that this kind of teenage romance is careless and unhealthy, and in turn they're able to grow from that and move beyond those kinds of things. Here, yeah, they really don't. They start off liking each other without really any, for no real reason, and then they end liking each other for no real reason. It's just sort of easy to digest.
And you've never had a relationship like that, where you're just like, I like this chick because I like her? Like,
just like
things
hit
off?
Realistic? Yes. Dramatically satisfying? Absolutely not.
I don't understand. I don't think
movies are responsible for depicting real life exactly it is. I think they're responsible for depicting like getting some sort of purpose out of it. And as a result,
you don't need to. It's an action movie. Like, what purpose do you really need to get out of it?
Well, I need to feel like these two characters are falling in love in an interesting and dramatically satisfying way. And
but not everybody falls in love in an interesting and dramatically satisfying way. Like,
yes,
as somebody who's been married for 12 years, I can tell you that that is not how real life is. And you don't always need to. You don't always need to have. The movies don't always need to predict this. Oh, everything is so dramatic. Things aren't always all that dramatic.
Well, the thing is, this is a movie. Movies are about drama. Conflict is the source of drama. There's no conflict to this romance.
There's conflict in the rest of the movie. Why does they need to have
conflict in the romance? Like, sometimes romance is just straightforward.
It's because they spent that screen time on it. I expect there to be some sort of point to it beyond, and now they just quit. Every single movie, they're each other. It's a waste of time.
I feel like the difference is that the drama or the conflict in their romance isn't between them, but between him being Spider-Man and her having to cop for a dad and kind of dealing with somebody who she knows is going to put his life in danger all the time. And at the same time, she puts herself in danger because she wants to impress him, which is how he gets stuff like the climax or her attacking the lizard in the school. So it's not necessarily like these two have problems, which we'll get to in the sequel. It's more like these two have each other, but they have a third element to their relationship, and how do they deal with that?
I guess I've sort of said all I can say about it. Like, it's just the least engaging romance I can imagine. Like, yes, Emma Stone is great. She is selling this gobbledygook really well. But just every time it comes to the screen, I'm just like, stop. You are barely characters. Move on. Is there anything else?
Going back and looking at the Raimi stuff, like,
yeah.
McGuire's impression of Peter and Kirsten Dunst's impression of Mary Jane are terrible. Like, they are barely characters. They're caricatures.
Let's look at it from this perspective.
Like, their relationship actually grows and changes through the movies. Like, they don't immediately,
like... We're talking about one movie, though. Like, their relationship doesn't really grow that much in Spider-Man 1.
It does.
Not really.
He's in love with her for the whole movie and never says anything until the end.
The thing is, there's no growth there. Yeah, well, there's her arc, though. You have to remember, it's her slowly coming to realize that this person is relevant and important to her. And then it's him coming to understand that that can't be part of his life because he has a responsibility to use his powers and he knows that would put her at danger.
And, like, but isn't that the arc that applies here in this movie, though? Like, that does... Those things happen. They're just way more subtle. Like, whereas Captain Stacy's like, I don't want you around her. Like, and...
I want to sort of loop back to a point on this later. I'd actually like to talk about Captain Stacy, because I think he is one of the two things this movie gets unquestionably right. I think he is a terrifically executed character.
Dennis Leary is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a combination of, Dennis Leary, he's great. And Captain Stacy, I think he's a really great character here. I mean, in every part of the movie, you understand exactly what he's thinking and why. Like, there's no part where you're trying to figure out through the... pointless wishy-washiness of how he is acting and why. There's always an understanding of who he is and what he's doing, and he actually does go through an arc through the movie. Like, he goes through that natural change of, like, understandably being distrustful and suspicious of Spider-Man to ultimately coming to accept him as something necessary for the city, and also understanding that in turn he should not be with his daughter. Like, I think, like, For the 90% of this movie that it gets wrong, Captain Stacy is great.
Yeah, I disagree with the 90% of the movie being wrong. But yes, he is a great casting choice. I would also say I think Uncle Ben is a good casting choice.
Yes, Uncle Ben is
so good.
Yeah, he's the other character. I mean, it helps that the guy Martin Sheen, he's one of those actors where part of his skill is feeling natural on screen, and in turn, he also becomes the kind of person who, every time he's on screen, you always know how he's feeling and why. It always feels natural. He's got a reasonable range of emotions. He feels like a human being.
And then they kill him.
Yeah, it was really weird, like, to watch him die, because at one point, I'm just like, oh, Peter, no, you poor child, and I'm just like, hey, wait, that's the elusive man. He's a total dick.
I see Martin Sheen and I think, wait a minute, it's that guy from Apocalypse Now. Shouldn't he be killing Marlon Brando right about now?
The thing I didn't care for as much was Sally Fields as Aunt May.
Really?
I think it's because she has nothing to do.
That's exactly why.
To be fair, Aunt May had nothing to do in the last two movies either, really.
She at least had important speeches to give to Peter and helped him to understand some of the points they were trying to make. Here... she has nothing, which sucks because Sally Field is a really good actress.
Odyssey speaking, before I rewatched it this weekend, I remembered her only having like two lines in this movie. She speaks a lot more once you rewatch it, but she says nothing of importance, which is why I forgot like everything she said in this film. The only thing I remember is to remember to bring the organic eggs.
Yeah.
And that's about it. So, yeah, she's, like, completely wasting this film. And it kind of sucks because she usually is the heart and soul of, like, the Spider-Man franchise. And she doesn't seem like she struggles as much. But I guess that's not a subplot in this movie. It's not about them being poor or him needing to take a second job or anything like that.
Real quick, so she knows that he's Spider-Man, right?
I feel like it's heavily implied.
That's the impression that I got from the first...
where it seemed like he was going to confess to her, but instead he just sort of postures mincingly at her.
I feel like the scene with the eggs kind of sort of confirmed it.
Yeah, and I think...
way that she looked at him.
I would agree with that if I hadn't just seen...
We'll get into that next week.
Which is why I don't think that she knows.
Even the sequel kind of hints at it, but they never outright say it, and it's like... It's like they kind of hint at it, and then they take it back. I felt that it was... Because, watching the end again, when the egg scene, and she looks at his face and stuff, you think that she knows, but she doesn't really say anything. And, again, seeing the sequel, it makes no sense. What did you think of the villain, Dr. Kirk Connors?
Okay, correction.
I liked him as Connors, not as the Lizard.
yeah, pre-injecting himself with the lizard stuff, yeah, I think he's the kind of thing I can understand. Like, okay, this is a guy who's trying to do science for the betterment of mankind, and then he's also bummed out because he doesn't have an arm. That's understandable. I have no idea what happens to him after he injects the lizard. Like, I think that kind of thing gives the really interesting potential story-wise to just be, like, essentially sort of a Jekyll and Hyde thing where he's constantly feeling ashamed of the stuff he does as the lizard.
Well, but the thing is, it starts off Jekyll and Hyde, but then it just kind of, like, morphs them into one full-on Hyde.
Yeah, like, I was wondering, like, basically after, like, what about putting the lizard thing turned him, like, gave him both his complete sanity and, like, constant into pure evil mode, regardless of whether or not he was human or a lizard. It was like, wait, what is this thing doing to him, and why?
Well,
how is this interesting?
When did he have the insanity as the lizard? I mean, as...
Well, it was kind of like...
Insanity,
I mean, like, it was,
yeah,
kind of like
I'm
about
like
halfway through, maybe.
Fully aware of all the stuff he was doing as the lizard while he was in Dr. Connors mode after injecting himself with it. Like, there wasn't really any mental difference between it.
Well, it seemed like the thing that was going through, and I think they did this with the rat, was that the reptilian DNA was just more aggressive, and it, so he started to take over, which is why he kind of fights with himself in the sewers with the videotapes. And it's like the more he fights with himself, the more the lizard kind of takes over and becomes the more aggressive side. But yeah, I mean, his grand scheme is kind of stupid.
Turn everybody into lizards.
Sort of, yeah, copies Magneto's plot from the first X-Men movie, except
well, to be fair,
really interesting.
He's done that before, and I think the comics and other cartoons.
That,
so it just sounds pretty stupid.
That's what
this
whole thing
is.
It's just a giant. It's a giant comic book plot. Like, there's
right.
nothing added to it.
So
yeah.
Okay, you could have used this to explore Jekyll Hyde. You know, it's just, nope, I guess he's evil.
Yeah. Although I did kind of like how he and Peter both had, like, animals of their own kind, like, slowly attracting themselves to them. Like, the little bit in the sewer, Peter's just waiting for him, and all the lizards, like, slowly emerge from, like, different web points.
Yeah, I actually like that bit he did with his powers in the sewers. Like, that, like... Like, yeah. Like most of this movie is very much is just paint the numbers again, but that was one of those, oh, this is kind of new. Could we do more of this?
I like seeing the montage of, like, Peter messing up and growing from those experiences as he, like, becomes Spider-Man. Like, that little montage where he's, like, saving people, and then when he's, like, testing out his web shooters up on the high on the roof and just, like, balancing himself and the skateboard.
Yeah, I actually kind of like the skateboard. Like, I think most of the power learning stuff very much just feels been there, done that, but that one actually felt genuinely fresh. I'm like, oh, is this what a Mark Webb Spider-Man looks like? Well, yeah, can I see more of this? This seems interesting.
Yeah, I actually enjoyed the part of him actually creating his webs, because, I mean, the organic web is easy for plot device in, and that you don't have to use it, but, you know,
it diminished Peter's character as well, like,
Yeah, he's supposed to be intelligent. He's the second in his high school.
He's just an idiot in those movies.
Yeah.
He's a complete moron.
He gets lucky.
Pretty much.
Though I would say I did see the sequel, so it's going to be hard to justify it next week.
Well, okay, but at least, like, it's like smart, like, slowly devolving. Well, it's like smart devolving into stupid. It's not just, like, stupid on top of stupid.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I'm basically indifferent on the web thing. I'm like, okay, natural webs, mechanical webs. It's one of those minor details that doesn't really affect it either way.
Well,
like, it's sort of like the costume. It's just a, like, texture, surface level choice.
Yeah, how did you guys feel about the costume? Because I know that a lot of people hated it.
I'm not a fan of this one. Like, I'm never a fan of that kind of basketball texturing thing. Like, the only character I can imagine that kind of thing working on is, like, Captain America, because his normal design sort of has that scale thing going for it. I think that might kind of work, but just like it doesn't really work on Superman and Man of Steel, it doesn't really work here. It just comes across very... Yeah? Like I said,
yeah.
Minor detail, but it's just a minor visually unappealing kind of thing.
Yeah, I didn't care for it, but it's not like, oh my gosh, I hate this movie because of it.
I didn't really mind it. It looked fine to me.
It looked like Spider-Man.
Yeah. I think part of that is because Andrew Garfield actually looks like you know, like a scrawny teenager, and Tobey Maguire like doesn't like physically wise doesn't really look like Spider-Man.
As long as it doesn't have nipples on it, I'm fine.
I'm kind of hoping they do that for Amazing Spider-Man 3. They just those, like put nipples on everyone's suit. Yeah. Just have like two little webs.
It'd be the Clone Saga.
Would it be two webs or would it be two spiders?
Moving on.
I think you wanted to grow extra arms in the next one, because I would support that.
I don't think the next one is going to have room for that based on the sequel.
Yeah.
But who knows? At this rate, they cram in everything in these films. It's like right. They expect now you have one movie.
We'll see. They want to get everything done with so that they can reboot it again quickly.
Probably. How did you feel about... I didn't realize it the first time I saw it, but he doesn't really use his... He doesn't really, like, have his spider sense in this movie.
He does, but he doesn't...
Does he?
Yeah. Because that's how... They when they do it on the train, it's kind of that weird... It's not like, it's kind of like the screen flashes real quick.
Yeah, and like, well, you know that he has it. Like, the first time that, like, he kind of uses it is on the basketball court when... He's over by the girl. He's helping her pick up the paint, and the ball comes back over. And like,
when I say he doesn't have it, I mean like it's not presented visually. It's just sort of something that like happens.
Yeah, it wasn't really presented visually in the Raimi trilogy.
Well, it kind of was, because you could always tell by like that sort of like buzzing sound.
Yeah, and I guess a really good example of that would be like when him and MJ are in the diner in the second movie, and he can sense that the
right.
being thrown at him. I actually don't mind that it's not called attention to. I suppose this is especially compared to the movie that follows this one, but yeah, I don't mind that it's just like a little subtle thing or that doesn't really come up that much.
Yeah. It's not a big thing, and I just think it's one of those, they probably, again, it's, I think it's one of those character traits that's just probably not something they want to call attention to too often, because it does kind of make it easy to tell stories with him. Oh, he can't, you know, like the only person who can escape it is Venom, and that would just be way too many complications. But yeah, it was that thing. I'm trying to think of what else happened in this movie of interest.
There's kind of sort of this subplot about Oscorp and its creator, but I guess that really ties more into the sequel, so
yeah, they make
we can't really talk about it.
I mean, it can be talked about here. Like, Connors is working on...
A cure for Norman Osborn's disease.
The stuff that Connors is working on is being financed by Norman Osborn because he's sick. You don't know why, you don't even see Norman.
He's dying.
Right.
Yeah, it's basically just... Like, compared to stuff like Iron Man 2 or other superhero movies, in terms of stuff that doesn't serve much of a purpose beyond world building, I like that it's very much just things in the background. Like, it's not obvious, hey, the only reason this character is here is so that they can appear in later movies, or this entire subplot with Agent Coulson showing it for this movie is just so that he can remind you that we're having an Avengers movie in 2 years.
Let's hope you have the same praise for the sequel.
I'm so glad Iron Man 3 course corrected from 2.
I still don't think Iron Man 3 is that great.
I'm pretty sure it's great, but I haven't seen it since it came out, but I'm like 90% sure it's great.
Yeah, I still think it holds up, but anyway.
Hold up for like a year.
Well, yeah, okay. I mean, like... Well, I mean...
How long have you been alive, Justin? Do movies just age that quickly for you?
I'm 2 years old.
Is the Grand Budapest Hotel already started aging?
I've never seen it.
It's early.
Shocker.
Wait, did it come out already?
Yeah, it came out like 2 months ago.
Oh, well, we'll hush my mouth then.
Okay, amazing.
How did you guys feel about the bridge scene, specifically with the kid?
Oh, yeah!
Because I actually really liked that scene.
I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah.
It was fun. Like, he had to make a choice. Like, do I chase after this giant lizard monster, which I may have possibly created, which
maybe
I think that's going to James' point earlier, where he does a selfish deed and he reveals his identity and hopes this kid is going to not tell people about it.
I do like that. Essentially, his first big action beat as Spider-Man is just saving someone.
Yeah. I thought it was a really good moment.
Had problems where they're more interested in big flashy weightless action scene, so I like that this one's actually starting off with, hey, you know what's my first action Spider-Man? I'm going to save this kid, because I'm a hero. And, you know, as proven with Iron Man 3's big barrel of monkey action scene, saving people is really exciting. Even if this scene is, you know, a little slow-paced and whatnot, it actually is. I do like seeing heroes save people. It tends to be cooler. I mean, you think about most of the great action scenes in superhero movies, how many of them actually are fights?
Well, generally, those fights are generally always the weakest part of the film.
Yeah, like, I'm trying to think how many legitimately great superhero movie fights there are. Like, as much as I love the train scene in Spider-Man 2, like, and while I think him fighting Ock is good, it's way more, like, the big part of it is him stopping the train.
Yeah, I would say Man of Steel Kansas fight, but I don't want to...
I think anytime, like, you have two heroes and villains that are on the same page, like, skill-wise or you know, strength-wise, then it works out a little better, which is why I really like Superman 2, like, the fight scenes there. Like, I think that they work, but everything else...
Which basically didn't try to stop Zod from killing everything.
Right, and it's like he's trying to stop somebody that is as strong as he is, and that's basically what happens in Man of Steel, like, which is why that fight is kind of fun.
Yeah, and I suppose another good example would be the Winter Soldier. In the Winter Soldier, the fight between Cap and... We can reveal the Winter Soldier's identity on here, right?
We could just call him the Winter Soldier.
Yeah, the fight with him, I guess not to spoil anything, it's very engaging because of the relationship that is revealed and established between those two characters makes it more engaging than just two superpower guys duking it out.
Yeah, I think there needs to be an emotional element, which is kind of why I think the climax of this film falls flat. I think part of it is also because the plot's stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah, it
very much is a dry fight, though, much as I've said many times, professing my love for Captain Stacy in this movie, him coming in to save the day, I'm like, yeah, you go. I like you better than the spider in this movie. You save the day.
Well, before we get there, we have to talk about our, I guess, bridge scene. That's what I'm calling these in Spider-Man films. The scene when the city riots behind him, and then this one.
Oh, yeah.
It's stupid, but I kind of dug it.
I think the concept of the cranes, I don't get why exactly needs a support, but I think it's because there was much in the movie that really... Like, apart from him saving that kid, and I think the kid was the son of that one crane operator,
yes.
There was very little of him, like, at the point where I felt like that, A, there was a reason the city had to openly reject him beyond the police sort of calling at him, and B, any much time where he really became, I guess, crane-worthy. Like, with Spider-Man 2, with them lifting him in the train, it's very much directly connected to him having just risked his life to save all of theirs. Here, it feels a little... It very much feels like an artificial way to try and create that sort of feeling.
Well,
and
it was kind of artificial in Spider-Man as well.
Especially like the first one and the last one. They just, they aren't really, like, deserved, like you said, but I feel like the two and Amazings are, like, direct results of him helping people.
Yeah.
I think if it had followed more of him directly trying to save people in New York from the lizard stuff within that climax, I think it would have been a lot more satisfying. As it stands, it feels a little... It feels forced in the same way that New York is helping him out in the first movie felt forced.
Yeah, it made for a cool visual, though. And on that note, I was also a fan of the first-person web shooting segment.
Oh, it was so cool.
Yeah, I think they were a little gimmicky at times, but I think occasionally they did give a nice feeling to the swinging scenes, which, granted, I think they nailed them well enough in 2 that they were only, like, the improvements from movie to movie were incremental, but yeah, they did look decent.
I dug the web swinging sequences in here because they felt like stuff that Spider-Man actually would do, and it, like, helps give the viewer that feeling of, like, you were with Spider-Man.
Yeah. Web swinging just seems so awesome. It was great to have more of it in here.
It's a thing that always, that kind of took me out of the first 3 because, like I said, Tobey Maguire was, like, physically too big, and he moves really slow. Whereas Andrew Garfield, like, he moves kind of like a free runner, and he has, like, he has like the build, and plus, like you said, the montage with the skateboard, like that sort of like gives you a general sort of like influence as to how he moves.
But he looks flexible.
Yes, that's
like,
it.
He looks like he can, because anytime you see Spider-Man in the comics, like when he's web slinging, like he's putting himself, he's contorting his body to like kind of give himself extra thrust as he's pulling himself along on the webs. And it was always awkward when, you know, they did it in the Raimi ones, or just right. this kind of muscular dude.
Right. I feel like he was pulling himself rather than like the web was pulling him.
Yeah. There's a nimble acrobat like component to his movement. Like minor thing, but nice little bit.
I'm sure some of that just comes with, you know, you have 12 years worth of extra CG technology and stuff to learn from. Like,
yeah, and you know, point of reference.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, going back to the climax, was anybody enthralled by it?
No.
What, the battle?
I don't think the fight is especially bad. I just think it's sort of there, partially because there was very little point where I understood why the Lizard was doing any of this. So as a result, it was just, okay, and now Spider-Man's fighting the Lizard, I guess. Like, way too much of this movie just felt too mechanical, and, like, it felt like it was made by a machine a lot of the time. Where it felt less of a dramatic, fuck yeah, he's gonna stop the Lizard and save the day, and, alright, he's fighting the Lizard.
Of like, the fights and the whole CG, and the fights and the action that was presented, that was probably the weakest one. I feel like the fight in the school, and the sewer, and him and Spider-Man web-slinging on their own are all pretty good, but the final battle doesn't really like hold up because it doesn't really accent like either of their strengths.
No, yeah. It's like we're watching them climb up a tower.
Basically.
Like, this is exciting. Whereas, like, you're seeing Lizard's strength in the school scene, and you're seeing Peter's, like, or Spider-Man's, like, acrobatic ability in those scenes, whereas you're not getting that with this. It's basically who can get to the top first.
And then you get a third party who interrupts and changes that anyhow. I did like him crushing his web shooters. I thought that was a nice touch of him running from previous battles.
Yeah.
And I also like to see him with using the grid ice to freeze him.
The nitrogen stuff.
Yeah, there we go. That was kind of neat. So, and I'm going to have the same complaint when we talk about the sequel.
Did we bring up the dad stuff?
What dad stuff?
It's not interesting enough to talk about.
Yeah, I was surprised, like they brought it up and he kept trying to make it a big deal, yet, I know a lot of this movie was heavily edited because the executives weren't really happy for it leading up to it. Like, I'm pretty sure the stuff with Peter Parker's dad was going to be very much more, like, relevant in this movie originally, and then it was cut down heavily to the point where, much like he sort of forgot about his hunt for Uncle Ben's killer, he just sort of forgot that he was sad that his dad was missing for some reason.
I actually did like that scene where he directly, like, calls Ben out about how his dad was supposed to teach him that lesson. It felt realistic.
Yeah, but I think what he means is, like, it's very inconsistent with him. Sometimes he's upset that his parents never came back, and other times he just seems happy.
I think that goes back to the teenager thing. It's like he just pretends he doesn't care because he doesn't want to dwell on it.
Very concretely established. He's like, not interesting.
It seemed realistic, though, because, like, there are days where it's like, this is really important to me.
Yeah,
really like, important to me, and then like
just like I don't care.
And like I'm not gonna worry about this now. Like even though it was really important to me, now
that
it's
reminds
not. Like that's,
that reminds me of one of my favorite editions is how they portray Flash, especially when his uncle dies, and Flash is the one who kind of.
I really like that scene.
Yeah,
forgot that happened,
but it's very nice.
Right, it gives Peter like. It gives him character. It shows that, like, you know, not everybody is out to get him all the time. There is compassion out there.
I feel like if they had shown something to make showed something to establish why Flash would change like that, it would have seemed like that. But instead, it just felt very much. It sort of lends to a lot of this movie that's very mechanical. Like, it's less driven by interesting story and character reasons, and more that the machine dictates that someone come to assure Peter that it's going to be all right.
No, I will disagree, because, I mean, they cognitively chose Flash for that scene. They could have chosen Gwen, they could have, you know, created another high school student, but I think showing that even this bully has a good side and understands when somebody's going through a rough patch, you never really know where help's going to come from.
Well, I think that would have worked better if that had been, like, part of the rest of the movie in any way. It's just sort of a one-off thing that doesn't add to anything, so as a result, it just feels like, wait, why is this character acting like this all of a sudden? Can we have some character arcs here?
I didn't get I'm with Earl on this. Like, that's something that seems realistic to me that would happen. Like, there are people that I don't like that I work with, but I find them complete jackasses. But you know, if a tragedy comes in, everyone kind of pulls together, and then you, like, hey, sorry about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it wouldn't have worked if it was Aunt May or Gwen, because we expect those people to be nice to Peter at this time. But somebody like Flash, who we have seen has been picking on him for most of this movie, coming to him and saying, you know what, I understand.
Right.
And even, you know, giving him a hug and whatever. And it's a very nice scene. And I think in general, Flash just gets a lot more to work with in this film.
I like the little scene at the end where, like, he wears the Spider-Man shirt. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was. It's a trait they didn't use in the Raimi films, because it's only
right.
The first one.
Kind of just get rid of him very early on.
Right.
Yeah, sadly that doesn't change at the sequel. Poor Flash.
They're supposed to be doing a Venom spinoff, so you know, maybe like one or two sequels down the line, we'll get like Flash Thompson Venom military agent.
So, question, by spinning off Venom, that means like spinning him off and out of movies and therefore out of my life. Like, they're going to spin him away and out, because Venom, he's so boring.
I like Agent Venom. Like
Eddie
Brock. Cool.
I like Agent Venom.
Has become interesting. I think Eddie Brock Venom is just boring Spider-Man, but big and evil. Until, like, the Spectacular Spider-Man. And
right.
Spider-Man 3 sort of made
the
more
interesting. If they went the Spectacular Spider-Man route, that would be... I feel like they'd be better for it.
Yeah.
That'd be a whole lot of retcon at this point, but...
Well, especially visually.
I suppose one last point. Does this movie have the most extraneous post-credit scene in a superhero movie? Yes or
no.
Absolutely?
No, right, because we have to talk about next week.
Next week doesn't have a post-credit scene. It has post-credit images.
It has a post-credit scene.
Yeah, it has absolutely
nothing to do with the film, but
it just feels completely jarring.
No, there's another post-credit scene that's extremely extraneous because you have to use an app to get it.
Yeah,
that one is.
Wait, which one are you talking about?
Okay, I suppose quickly to spoil the next Spider-Man cast. After the credits in The Amazing Spider-Man 2, because of some contractual obligations between corporations. There is a trailer for X-Men Days of Future Past.
Is it even a trailer? It seems like
no, it's not
like
a trailer. It's just like 2 minutes. It's just like 2 minutes. It's a 2 minute clip.
Like a trailer. But the point is, there is a scene from a completely different movie in a completely different company.
From a completely different company, though.
No, you know the next part? When I went to go see it, I swear I heard like two people go, "Oh my god, X-Men or Spider-Man crossing over."
Yeah,
that's everybody's natural reaction.
Exactly.
Why else put it there?
They've literally just like
confused everyone.
The post credit scenes are usually just like, hey, are just things to hint to things in other movies. Here, they're literally just putting an advertisement after. But we'll get to that one next. This post credit scene, where mysterious guy visits Dr. Connors and Tristan to ask Peter if he knows about his father. Basically reminding the audience, oh yeah, they talked about his father for a bit in this movie. And then he leaves. So basically, as someone pointed out when this movie first came out, the scene really reveals nothing other than we are making a sequel. We have no idea what we're doing with it yet.
Up until, you know, this recent sequel, I guess everybody thought that it was Electro, and now those plans have been quashed.
So apparently,
small spoilers, he's called the Gentleman.
I believe they called him Mr. Fierce.
In comic book terms,
okay.
he's called the Gentleman. And I guess his name's like Gustavo Fierce, or however you want to say that. So I'm not entirely sure like what his role is besides being like an Osborn stooge.
That's good enough for this franchise because
according to like the rumor mill, he's supposed to be like the Agent Coulson as far as like the Sinister Six, but like he's nabbing all these people and like recruiting them and all that shit.
But I thought you, when you said that, I thought you were going to say that this film doesn't know when to end. Because I thought it should have ended at the funeral, and then it probably should have ended.
Oh, yeah, I almost forgot about this.
Yeah,
yes.
It's weird how
the last thing our hero does is break a promise that he made to a dying man. This is our hero, by the way.
Yeah, all teenagers do that.
But that's the thing, though. It gets to the point where this character has learned nothing, like going back to that thing. This is a guy who just saw a man die in front of him and promised him, "I will not date your daughter."
He never promised anything.
Last time I remember, Stacy just said, "Dude, stay with my daughter." I don't remember Peter actually saying, "I'm totally going to do that."
Yeah, he did not agree or disagree.
But that's the thing, though. When Gwen was talking to him, he basically admitted that, yeah, he essentially promised, if not verbally, that he would stay away from his daughter.
No, he said that her dad told him to stay away from her.
Yes, and then she's
that
like...
That doesn't mean he promised.
He heard a reasonable and rational request for a dying man, and then he was like, nope. And this is our hero, by the way. Like, this is the guy they expect us to root for, and then they're all like, oh yeah, this is the kind of guy who will break a promise to a dying man. It's been 2 hours of movie, he hasn't learned a single lesson, he does not know that his great power requires him to be responsible for things. Why are we root for him? I mean, other than because the movie tells us to.
I will just say this much. I don't necessarily agree with your thing, but I felt like they should have stopped that and saved it for the sequel.
If they stop at the funeral, that would have been like the great, like, stop at the funeral and then just like skip to the phone call part and the little part where he's like traveling through the city.
Yeah, well, even then, that was like you had this and you had the school scene and then you had him swinging, and it's like, okay, at some point you have to end.
Yeah,
it suffered from Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Well, see, Lord of the Rings was you were there, that was at least them rewarding you after having.
No, there was no reward in 5 minutes of
ending. Like, oh no, our character hasn't learned anything. He's actually the same. Hold on, how did someone describe it? The same whiny, self pitying, narcissistic, self indulgent asshole.
So I'm talking Spider-Man 3.
What? As someone described it, as this comment said, this Peter kind of reminded me of myself, a whiny, self-pitying, narcissistic, self-indulgent asshole. So I had fun watching him hook up with Emma Stone.
Yeah, like I said, I think it would have been a nice emotional hook for the second one. And it is kind of where the second one starts off to spot that, but it's like, why did you like do it if you're just going to take it apart at the start of the next?
Well,
film?
Yeah, and it kind of makes me wonder, like, how many times has he done that since in like the past year? And
yeah, we'll get back to that.
Two people have died because of him, and he still hasn't learned anything from it. I mean, this is one of the least like there kind of isn't a story to this movie. When you come down to it, I mean, it's been over two hours, and our hero is basically the same kind of, occasionally he's going to help people, occasionally he's a self-centered jerk person that he was at the beginning. He's gone in a circle, arrived nowhere, and has,
so
the
like
only
a
thing
normal
that happened
person.
To him is that he has a hot girlfriend and superpowers.
I mean, to be fair,
he's a lot like Korra in Legend of Korra, in that he learns nothing and is rewarded for it.
Well, I mean, in that regard, it kind of follows in the footsteps of the very first movie, where not much happens. There's no real plot.
Actually, just to become a different person by the end of that movie.
Think
about him when he first gets his powers and he's using them for selfish personal gain. He then learns that that's wrong and then uses them solely for the selfish, for the selfless desire to help others, and in turn selflessly gives up the possibility of love. Because he knows of the danger that it would go to him. Like, he actually grows as a person. The Peter Parker at the beginning of Spider-Man 1 is a different than the one at the end of the movie. He's learned nothing.
I will say this much. I am going to give, as I've seen the sequel, I'm going to give them the on game because I do think...
Okay, with all due respect, fuck that. Like, I do not think that just because, like, this is actually the sort of the worst example of serializing to just say, oh, no, no, he's going to learn less than the sequel. This is not the sequel. This is one movie.
I get that, but I don't...
Exactly.
Like, for example, Amazing Fantasy 15 is a, like, what, 15-page comic in which Peter changes completely in terms of learning that lesson of great power versus great responsibility. This movie lasts 136 minutes, and he does not change at all. He is the same whiny, self-pitying, narcissistic, selfish jerk at the end of the movie that he was at the beginning of the movie.
Regardless, I still like him better than the Raimi stuff.
Oh, fuck that. I will take a hero who I actually like. Like, there's no reason to root
for him. I like this guy.
Why do you like
him? Tobey Maguire is so whiny.
Yes, but he's actually a good person. Like, he's a guy who has a world of shit thrown at him and still tries to find a way to be a good, to grow and actually help the world out of that. This is a guy who has everything handed to him, still bitches about it, and in turn gets a hot girlfriend.
He had nothing handed to him.
Yes, he did. He got spider powers randomly handed to him. And he's not.
Yes.
He just learned to.
So did Maguire.
He moves away from selfishly using them to selflessly losing them. I mean, the main thing he does in this movie is stop the thing he created. There's no learning of responsibility for the rest of the world. It's all selfish desires.
Is it selfish if, even if you're doing it, it's still, it's benefiting other people? Like, I would imagine.
That's the thing, though. It's to keep his conscience clear. It's not because he knows that he has to use these powers for good. It's so he doesn't have to feel bad about himself.
But to me, that's a more realistic approach than...
Yeah.
Realistic, yes. Dramatic, no. And this is a movie. Movies are about drama. There's no drama to this movie.
Even the giant is it guy he has to fight? Never mind. But I imagine we're just going to go in a circle with this for a while. So to kind of speed it up, since we are hitting the hour mark, and we're going to start with James since he seems so high on this movie. What do you give The Amazing Spider-Man out of 7?
Out of 7, the most I could reasonably justify giving it is a 2. It has a lot of nice texture stuff with some of the performances and visuals. But again, this is a movie. Movies read stories. This movie doesn't have a story. It has a whiny, self-pitying, narcissistic asshole who is then rewarded with superpowers and a hot girlfriend. Fuck that guy.
Are you saying that you like Spider-Man 3 more than this film?
I think I gave Spider-Man 3... Okay, Spider-Man 3 is a broken movie, but it at least knows what it wants to do with its character and actually have a story. This one...
On that one.
Yeah. When's the last time you watched Spider-Man 3?
I'll say it right now. Spider-Man 3 is a bad movie, but infinitely better than The Amazing Spider-Man.
Okay.
Keep talking. Give me a minute.
Okay, what do you give this, Chris?
If you think this was fun, just wait till we talk about the next one. I mean, I basically feel about it. Like, you know how medieval torture chamber guys are given all their tools and say, hey, this guy's a horrible person, go nuts on him? That's basically how I felt after I saw this movie. I'm like, oh, this is going to be real easy and fun. All right, who's next?
Chris, what do you give this?
I enjoyed it. I found it fun. I found it more realistic than me. I disagree with James that it doesn't have a story. There is a story. What's the story? Peter get. What's the story? Peter.
Yeah. What's the story?
Peter becomes Spider-Man.
He fights the lizard.
No, like, that's a story.
What's the lesson?
There doesn't need to be a lesson in a story.
That's what stories are about.
No, stories are not always about lessons.
No, okay.
They can be about entertainment.
Ancient Greeks.
Movies can be about entertainment. Not everything needs to be about learning something. Yeah, and that's where, like, I found this to be entertaining. And sometimes that's all I need from a movie. I don't need to learn something from it. You know what? I have Raimi's movies from that, and they're garbage. Like, after watching this, I can't go back. I find this on par with the original Raimi movie. And
you're insane.
This is so beautiful.
I mean, this is like the most...
Not everything needs to be about something.
Yes, but if everything needs to, everything that pretends to be about something needs to be about something, and if all you're going to do is have your God mirror character be an asshole and learn from that, no. Fuck the Hollywood.
No, it's okay that you don't like it, but not everything needs to be about something.
That's what stories are.
What is this pretending to be?
It's pretending to be a search for identity. I mean, they make it a very both clunkily literally, and I mean, you think about that stinger at the end when he's in the classroom, when they talk about their only one question, who am I? Like, it's trying to make that thing very literal, but he hasn't learned anything about who he is other than, again, whiny, self-pitying, narcissistic, self-indulgent asshole. And, okay, we'll get into that more with the next one, which... Amazing Spider-Man 2 is the worst superhero movie ever made by a long
time. Oh, wow, I can't wait till next week because you are so wrong.
Oh, my God.
It's going to be awesome.
Okay. Time out. We'll save this for next week. Justin, what did Chris give it? He didn't give it a score.
I am putting it on the same level as I put the original Raimi movie, which was my highest rated from the previous three. I'll give it a 5. and here's the thing, I would prefer to watch this one over the Raimi stuff.
Oh, shots fired.
Justin, what do you...
The web-slinging and the performances are enough for me to give this like a 5. I like that it's a fresh take with some interesting characters. It is a little bit long, and the villain is kind of meh, but it's just a fun, solid film.
Okay. And I'm going to echo what they're saying, and I'm going to give it a 5 as well. Like I said before, I think it's a much better cast, and I think they do much better in their roles. I think a lot of this running cast has a lot more to work with than pretty much anybody who wasn't named Peter in the first movie. Harry didn't have much of an arc. Mary Jane didn't have much of an arc. Green Goblin just went crazy. I don't know how you should... I guess it was just William Dafoe's performance. I don't see how...
William Dafoe.
Yeah, I don't see how he's much better than the lizard in this movie. He has no... We mentioned that in the first...
Him abusing his powers for selfish things is sort of a reflection of Peter using his selfless. Like, here it's just... And then he's evil, I guess.
I mean,
happened in the first one.
But he got to the first one. Like, we didn't understand why he just went crazy. Like, he just started talking to himself in the mirror. But yeah, I don't mind either one of them. I would just say that I prefer the cast. I think they are a lot more suited for the roles. I have Garfield's Spider-Man and his Peter. It's a different Peter for a different age. He's a bit more hipster than he is.
Is this our age? Fuck, I already hate my generation.
It is your age.
Can I join older people in hating my generation?
I'm older than you, and I don't hate your generation.
Yeah. Right, I hate my generation.
You'd have to like go even further.
You have to go to like the 60s.
Awesome.
The big beat I have for this is the excessive side shots, especially with his parents. And... his dad setting up the greatest Rubik's Cube ever as far as puzzles that he needs to solve somehow. I guess he just imagined his son would be a super genius. But we'll get more into that with the sequel. So, yes, for James, Chris, and myself,
gonna be fun.
This is the Amazing Spider-Cast for the Amazing Spider-Man.
Tell your friends.